So I'm really excited to tell you more about this many-body quantum chaos work and also spectral form factor work. So last 4 years, I think there is some genuine progress being made, and there are lots of different directions, both in high energy physics and also in condensed matter physics, where we did lots of stuff. Okay, so first I'd like to thank my collaborators, John Chalker, who was my PhD supervisor. I thank him especially for this, and David, and Tomasz Prosend, and Andrea, and postdocs, we have Sanjay, Apinov, Aaron, and then also the students that who work a lot with me, Jachin, Salmia, and Stephen. Stephen, who was a summer student of mine for 2 summers. Okay, so the overview, I'll talk about many-body quantum chaos for closed systems, and then for open systems. And for both cases, I'll talk about, in particular, about spectral correlation. But our teams also work in other things like eigenstate correlation, extensions or correlations beyond ETH, entanglement entropy growth, things like that. Okay, so these are some of the papers along the way. It's not the complete papers, but it started off in 2018. And also for open systems, it started off with a paper earlier this year. So we're interested in asking a very basic question. So if we're given a Hamiltonian or some other things like a quantum channel, where you can diagonalize them and get the eigenvalues for Hermitian Hamiltonians, then these eigenvalues would be real. For quantum channels or for Lindblad or other things, the eigenvalues would not be real, would be complex and generally in a complex plane. Our question is about what kind of universal signatures can you obtain from eigenlevel correlations and other things in generic quantum many-body systems. And those are quite a hot questions 5 years ago, but recently there's a paradigm shift towards using like random quantum circuits and SYK models, among other things, that helps us to understand these systems and correlations more. So level correlations, two of the main things why we're interested in them is because many systems display universal signatures in level correlation. That's one of them. And also, it is a very robust signature of quantum chaos, and as we will see. So if we're given let's talk about the closed systems case where we have a Hermitian Hamiltonian. We're given a Hamiltonian, like we can diagonalize the Hamiltonian and get the eigenlevel. And then we can ask we can compute all the gaps, which I call Gn, and then plot the distributions of these gaps. If the distribution fits the so-called Wigner-Dyson distribution, obtained from random matrix theory, which we will discuss more, then we call that the system is quantum chaotic. This is a conjecture given by Bohnhagen, Giannoni, and Schmidt back in the days. And if the, in particular, that distributions have something called a level repulsion, where when the gap goes to zero, there are no probability of finding pairs of eigenvalue with those gap. On the other hand, if you see that the distribution fits the blue line, which is which is given by the Poisson distribution, it just means that these levels are independently, they are not correlated. So that means that the system is not chaotic in particular. Okay.
Yes. What is the content of the conjecture?
The conjecture is about spectral correlation. So if you want to be more specific, so what they saw is that they saw different analogies. So they saw they see that there are systems where there's a classical analogy, and they see that the classical analogy is chaotic, and then they do numerical simulations for the quantum version of those systems, and then when they see that they plot these level correlations, they look into the level correlations around the mean level spacing. And then they see this distribution. So the content is this, the statement is this: the distribution of the systems looks like the distributions of random matrix theory. By definition, when I'm talking about distributions, I'm talking about mean level spacing. Then we call it as quantum chaotic.
Quantum chaotic in the sense that the corresponding classical system is chaotic?
Like- yes, this is more like a conjecture. Because it began with these systems with a classical analog, but then it extends to systems without a classical analog. For instance, systems of fermionic degrees of freedom. There's no classical analog, but you can still, we'll still use this definition as a definition of chaos. If it shows this, then you say it's chaotic. But there are also other ways where people characterize it. For instance, like eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, looking at the operator and the matrix elements in the basis of eigenstates, and discuss how the distributions, how these matrix elements correlate, and also there are other things like entanglement entropy growth. So this is the active research topic. What's the definition of chaos?
Okay.
So next. So I mentioned this distributions are obtained from random matrix theory. So we can talk about just very briefly about how random matrix theory comes about. So for generic quantum chaotic systems that are, for instance, another way of saying it is that it's non-integrable. These systems are very, very hard to solve. If you want to solve a particular system, maybe you diagonalize it, but then what you can do is very limited. So Dyson and Wigner and many great pioneers of random matrix theory show us that instead of thinking about one single system, you want to think about an ensemble of many different realizations, and then to compute the statistics of this ensemble. You can think of each realization as a randomly drawn Hamiltonian or a randomly drawn time evolution operator for your system. So for a Hamiltonian, this is the simplest case would be the so-called Gaussian unitary ensemble. You can think of it as each matrix element having a Gaussianly random number. And then you, on top of that, you impose that they are Hermitians, and then you can further impose different symmetry classes. And similarly for unitary, that is used to model a time evolution operator. And that is a flat distributions on the unitary group. And the advantage of using this is that you see universality, which is the conjecture we talked about just now. And then this is also, because this model is simple enough, you can have some analytical tractability. But random matrix theory was not enough. So if you want to talk about many body quantum chaos, then you can observe that for random matrix theory, actually by definition, you can do a basis transformation of the ensemble, and the distribution is unchanged. So you can change to any basis. But in reality, we know that for generic many body quantum systems, if you have a local perturbation, then there will be some the influence of this perturbations would grow linearly given by the Lie-Robinson bound up to some exponential correction. So there's a notion of locality or preferred basis, if you like, in the generic many body case, but not in the random matrix theory case. So this this was helped by a seminal paper by Adam Nahum and collaborators, where they first solved this this random quantum circuit, which incorporates both random matrix theory, which allows you to have some analytical tractability, and a locality, a geometry in the system. So we're giving you a time in the y-axis, and in the x-axis, the space. And each site, you can think that you have a 1D lattice, and each site contains some degrees of freedom. And you can say that there are Q levels. And if it's spin system, spin half system, it will be 2-level. And you have these gates acting on them. These gates would be the simplest. And we found that actually when these gates are drawn from the CUE, then as a so-called circular unitary ensemble, which are flat measure on the unitary group. So any unitary in the unitary group is as likely as the other one, then this is solvable. In particular, after every time step, there's disorder in space. So each of these gates are different. They are also disorder in time. So disorder or randomness in time. So after every time step, you add a layer of gates that are new onto them. This approach gives the simplest case, but there are some correlation in time that are not being captured here. And another way of saying this is that you don't have a well-defined spectrum, because after every time steps, I'm going to add another set of gates there. So the spectrum keeps changing. So in order to keep the spectrum, what we did is to study the flow K version of the random quantum circuit. So we have the same kind of diagrams, time in y-axis, space here, Q degrees of freedom, and these are Hall random unit trees or other variations of that. And precisely these are defined this way. And this is the thing we study. And the spectral statistics are something that is what the random quantum circuits cannot capture. Okay, so this begins in 2018. So if we go back to the big picture, we have this theory space of a 1D spatially extended system. In the beginning, we have this zero-dimensional model, random matrix theory, which found to describe lots of level statistics and different things when the energy scale is small. And then you add more structure to go to random quantum circuits. And we are here. Currently, what I'm describing today is the flow K random quantum circuits, where there's a spectrum for you to discuss. And you can add more and more structures in order to describe microscopic model more. So for microscopic models, there are certain models that can be described, for instance, integrable models. But these are generally non-generic. And also there, for 1D systems, there would be a so-called dual unitary circuits, which are also recently quite another parallel directions that people pursue. Okay. Object.
Sorry, I think there was a question.
Right.
Someone raised hand.
Sure. Yeah. So, hi, Amos. So my question was, can you clarify what was the reason for going to this Lockett RQC? Like, what was the issue with the spectrum? Was it that it wasn't stable in time? Like,
as in there isn't even one. So if you were to repeat this, mm-hmm. then you could have repeat this, and then it would effectively, you are actually solving a flow K random quantum circuit, just a flow K circuits with many layers. So this actually the thing you want to solve is basically this thing. So if you have many layers and you repeat it, you effectively have a system that have interactions that are slightly larger, but effectively the physics would be contained in this kind of circuit, but there is no spectrum here, and also there are different peculiarity that are different physics that are not capturing completely random circuits. For instance, if you look at correlation function for these kind of circuits, then it would go to zero in one time steps. But we are very interested in studying this model as well, because this models, if you study things like second Renyi entropy or out of time correlator, then each gate appear in two pairs, like you have this guy and then the conjugate and then another pair of that correspond to two design. Mm-hmm. So the two design, I think actually many people in PI work on these quantum information stuff, but this two designs allows you to have basically the simplest non-trivial kind of correlation between this unitary gate. But when we do this kind of flow K stuff, we repeat it for many times. So in other words, when we the design we're talking about, the moment that we're talking about that we need to compute grows in time. So which is the difficulties of actually studying this flow K system? And actually that's the reason why often there are some results for finite Q for these guys, but for these flow K systems, usually the analytical part of the results are in large Q, which is the main approximation we use. But then for finite Q, we just study numerically, for instance.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, so for spectral form factor, we can start with asking, so given a density of states, the usual one, we can ask, what is the two-level correlation? Which is asking, what is the probability of finding two levels with distance omega, given by this R omega? And you can Fourier transform this and get this, the object that we want, which is the spectral form factor. And these energy levels just turns into phases. And yes, Okay, and I'll give you a brief recent historical overview of what happened. And it began in 2017, mid-2017, where they found that black hole, described by toy models like SYK, in late time, can be described by random matrix theory, or in small energy scale corresponding, can be described by random matrix theory. So then, after that, there are lots of works on SYK and random matrix theory, and they're also interested in holographic principles on the other side, in gravity. How does the SFF give them information about gravity? And then in end of 2017, we started working on this 1D 1D model. So this SYK is zero dimensional. I assume many of you have heard of that, zero dimensional auto coupling, but maybe you have a four body coupling, etc., four local coupling. But this is mainly for zero dimensional. They're one dimensional work, but it's not as powerful. It's much harder to work on a 1D version of SYK. For spatially extended, there are very few models where you can solve exactly analytical tractable models where you can do. And we work on one of them, which is a flow K random quantum circuits with the main approximation of using large Q, which we discussed just now with the question. And the other one is actually by Tomáš Prosen's team and Bruno Bertini, Pavel Kos. They first work on a model that's long range, and then they work on a model that's self so-called dual unitary, which I can describe more later when there's a chance. It basically means that you can exchange space and time and require that the circuit is unitary also in space. So it's not generic, but it's something, because it allows you to solve for Q equals two, for example. Okay. And then recently there are also attempts to propose experimentally realizable schemes. And Solar is one of the groups that are trying to do that. And they talk about different things. Recently, they have a series of paper on randomized measurement to try to measure that. But this is still in early stage. Okay. But there are lots of activities there out there. Okay. So after the literature review, we can go back to the simplest case for understanding SFF, which is to understand it. What happens when you have Gaussian unitary ensemble? You plot in K in the y-axis and then T in the x-axis. You first see a dip, which is given by the disconnected contribution of this guy. So it dependent on the shape of the density of states, and generally that is not universal. So actually we're not particularly interested in the dip itself, but later on we'll also see in early time there's another bump out there. So sometimes people try to distinguish between the dip and the bump, etc. Okay, so there's the dip here, and then after the dip vanish, there'll be linear time growth. So K is proportional to T until the time is so large that is comparable to the one over level spacing, i.e. to the matrix size. That time scale is the time scale so large that you're probing an energy scale so small that it's smaller than the mean level spacing. Afterwards, there are no meaningful physics for the systems. So and turns out that you get the flat version. We'll also talk quite a bit about the SFF for the circular unitary ensemble, the unitary circuit version of that, because it's actually particularly clean, because unitary ensemble has density of states around a circle. So even without minusing the disconnected part, you get just a linear line of T. And then when you hit the so-called Heisenberg time, then you get a plateau. And I want to give a brief intuition of how this T can arise. You can think one way of writing SFF is to write it as a trace of the time evolution operator U as a function of T. Typically it's to the power of T, and then U dagger to the power of T. You can represent each U as a black dot here, and represent each U dagger as a white dot here. And this trace is represented by this line connecting all the dots. And the ensemble average of the spectral form factor can be roughly described as connecting all the black dots, finding all possible ways of connecting all the black dots with the white dots. It's kind of like a weak contraction, which is a simplified version. The full version is slightly more complicated and use the so-called Weingarten calculus. In this sum, okay, sorry, you should have a plus dot dot here. In this sum, in particular, there will be diagrams that dominate when the matrix size tends towards infinity. And these diagrams are these three for t equals three. So I'm considering t equals three. So there are three dots here. Just means that there are three unit trees. And these diagrams dominate because actually there is a notion of loops here. So you can change it to Terhoff's double line notation, and you see that there's actually some loops here. I'm just going through it very quickly, but there are some loops here. And this tells you that these diagrams actually turns out to have the maximal number of loops. Okay, perhaps this is easy to see. The first diagram, the fact that it has the most number of loops. The second diagrams, you can just consider this green circle, and you can consider moving this green circle around the black line to the other side. And you will see that the second one is topologically the same as the first one. So actually the number of loops of this diagram is the same. And you can do that t times, which gives you the the ramp t here. And this will go back to this diagram, which is also one of the main two that we use, this diagrammatic approach. Okay, great. So that concludes the intro. I wonder if there are any questions, we feel free to ask. Okay, so if not, we can go to the for the many-body quantum systems for the closed version. So to understand the many-body aspect, what I told you just now was just for the entire system coupled together with no local structure. Now we want to compute it for the quantum circuits. As physicists, we want to the simplest thing is to understand the limits, different limits of the system. The fully coupled one would be described by the COE. So as before, you have linear ramp and then a plateau. And then the extreme limit would be the uncoupled one, where you have each site evolving as independent circular unitary ensemble. So these are all random matrices. You can compute this, and you will see that each site would give you a factor of t. So for L sites, it will give you t to the power of L until it hits a plateau where there is some non-perturbative effects, cancellations going on to give you the plateau. But the point is, in the fully coupled limit, you have a linear line, and the uncoupled limit, you have this higher slope. So if you consider actually an interacting spin chain, in early time, you know that different part of the systems did not have time to talk to each other yet. So in early time, you actually would have something like this. And in late time, you have this. So you what you expect is the interpolation between the two. So you have this and this interpolating between them. And you can think of the early time as giving you some kind of different part of systems effectively evolve independently. And then their influence get larger and larger. Eventually, random matrix theory onset. And this defines a new time scale called Thales time, which denotes the onset of random matrix theory for spectral, for SFF. There are other time scales, scrambling time, etc., for other quantities. But this one is particular for the SFF. Okay, so again, Thales time is the time after which spectral form factor coincide with the spectral form factor of the random matrix theory. We will actually have a picture in terms of the diagrams that I present just now to understand this, which I'll present soon. Okay, great. So one of the models that we can solve precisely under the approximation of large Q is a so-called random phase model. We can also solve the brick wall models that I showed earlier with the kind of the brick wall structure. For this random phase model, we have Q degrees of freedom again, and it has two layers, U1 and U2. The first layer is given by a random matrix CUE, and each site is drawn independently. In the second layer, we have what we call random phase gate. These are diagonal matrix So it doesn't change the incoming and outgoing, doesn't change the incoming color. So with delta AC and delta BD. And then it assigns a random phase. And this phase is Gaussianly distributed for a mean around zero and some variance controlled by what I call epsilon, which will show up later. This model gives lots of fruitful results and gives one of the first non-trivial results for SFF for a spatially extended system. And recently we also study and get some nice spectral form factor results for translational invariant ones. And there are other variations that we'll talk about. So how do you actually solve this? We go back to revisit the spectral form factor function again. It has trace U and trace U dagger. So we represent trace U in terms of the white sheets here. And the trace here is represented by these line, which is meant to connect with the bottom line like this. So this is a trace U. I hope we're fine with that, with time going upwards and space going horizontally. The U dagger, as you would expect, would be the gray one in the back. And for this particular model, you can actually average these guys, the first layer, U1 and U2 independently. So if you average over U1, because each site evolving under separate independent CUE, you can actually do each site independently. So the first site in large Q would actually exactly give you back this the three diagrams that we talk about. If T equals 3, which is currently the case, we have three CUE here, will give you the three diagrams here. And for other sites, similar things happens. You also have this T degree, T configurations each site can take. This gives you an effective spin chain with T degrees of freedom at each site. And then if you integrate the second layer over U2, you'll find that the Boltzmann weights in large Q. So again, I have always been using a large on-site dimension approximation. For large Q, the Boltzmann weights between site I and site I plus one says that if they are if they coincide, then there's no cost for taking that configuration, that pairs of configuration. If they're different, then there is a cost given by epsilon t. So you can think of epsilon t. Okay, so this is obviously the POTS model interaction, and this is a classical chain. So this is actually the first quantum classical mapping that I'm presenting to you guys. And one interesting thing is that this interaction, this classical model has a beta j equals epsilon t. So that's quite interesting. So as time goes higher and higher, the interactions are forced to be stronger and stronger. And this is a ferromagnetic chain because it favors spins to take the same configuration along the chain. Yeah.
In the previous introduction, you didn't mention you need to use large Q for the...
Indeed.
Actually, you don't have to go back. Yeah, I was referring here. You didn't...
Yes, I don't need to. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that. Yeah, I want to give you this intuition just because it connects with what I say. Actually, yeah. So, but you don't need to. You can compute this exactly. So these references are like Hark's book and like Matter's book. But thanks for the comment. Yes, I should have.
So I want to ask, in the current slide, why did you have to use large Q?
Because it's hard, in short. But let me see if I can say more about why is it hard. So, for instance, these kind of integration over CUE use some kind of so-called Weingarten calculus. And those kind of calculus means that actually when you try to integrate over these guys, the summation you're doing as a perturbations in 1/Q actually gives you terms that are both positive and also negative. So these negative terms are often hard to understand. So you can do contrary expansion, but then that is also very hard. Probably you want to do something, use a different method to capture effects that are non-perturbative. So basically, the sum is quite hard to compute. I mean, it's definitely well known that I assume many of you also try to tackle these kind of problems where finite Q, many body, strongly correlated systems, the entire spectrum is quite hard to understand. So currently, I'll tell you more what is out there, but basically the dual unitary, these random quantum circuits, and also this SYK, but that is for quantum dots. Are the only few things that can be done currently.
And here, the usage of large Q is only within a large Q limit. You can reduce this problem to the previous one?
Yes, you can reduce this problem to the parts model one for this problem. But I will show in a few slides later that this kind of results are actually quite universal. We will have scaling forms that different models would fit, which we're happy about that. But you need some kind of luck. I mean, you have to capture. So we'll tell you what kind of things we think are universal.
Yeah, thanks. But let me just make sure. So you related this right middle right figure to the lower right figure. Do you have to use large to make the connection?
To only talk about this, you need large Q. So if you go to finite Q, you have to talk about a lot more diagrams, basically.
I see.
I myself have done some think have thought quite a bit about these kind of problems. And for instance, for this particular problems, I can see actually I did a finite Q calculation. The perturbations. For the second order, et cetera. I see cancellations up to like 1/Q to the fourth, I think. Let's say 1/Q to three. Seems that they're everything cancels somehow.
I see. Go
ahead.
Sorry. What's epsilon?
Epsilon is the variance of this guy. I should have made notes here. So the variance of this guy would be epsilon.
Thanks.
So when epsilon, so to recap this, we have mapped a quantum, we're calculating a quantum, strongly correlated quantum object. And that could be mapped to a partition function of a classical object, classical model. And this classical model has peculiarity, which is that each site takes T degrees of freedom and the interaction is a parts model one and it's ferromagnetic. So we can take different limits. So for instance, when time is super late, it means the interaction is super strong. So it means that the entire system wants to stay in the completely just a single color, one of the T colors. I give this intuition of explaining this guy in terms of this classical model. In late time, the entire chain would occupy the same degrees of freedom, same color, sorry. In early time, you get this order regime for sufficiently large T. Okay, so I have many different sites. You get this kind of different colors. And what governs Dallas time around this region is just having a one domain wall. So this domain wall is actually, we believe that these are universal. Basically, different part of the systems take different degrees of freedom. You can think of it as these kind of diagrams. And you can, obviously, this domain wall in the classical models would have these entropic contributions of, there'll be L of them, polynomial in L. So then if you want to compare T and L, actually, you want to compare this T and L, L would have to go to the exponent. So you actually would have some scaling of log L going there because of the entropic contribution of this domain wall configuration. And this domain wall is one of the first understanding of these spatially extended system. So this starts with 2018, and we also recently also check out my supervisor John's and his other students' work focus on this, and we also recently worked on the trace translation invariance problem, and we delve more on this again. So we're kind of thinking flow K system as a translational invariant in time, in although in discrete time, and then we also study as a general framework. Also study the other case, which is translation invariant in space. But when you also introduce different conserved charge, you will see that actually T-thallus, you will have some diffusive mode in the system. So T-thallus actually goes as L square. And we also study things like, recently there are also lots of activities on these fractonic models, stuff like that. Dipole conserving model with Hilbert space fragmentation. Those kind of models, we can analytically show in large Q that have goes as L to the 2M, T-thallus. But T-thallus is not the only thing that we can do. We can actually, for several systems, we can get the exact expression for K and also try to get some scaling expression, going to some scaling limits to large T and large L to get something. So this the inset is the so because it's a 1D pos model, we can solve that exactly. So the inset is the partition function given here. And this is the numerics. They qualitatively share similarities. You can see the bump here, the ramp here, and then plateau here, plateau somewhere up there. You can go to the scaling to compare these two. You can go to a scaling limit. So to show some different universality. So consider this diagram here. This plot denotes the regime of different behavior of spectral form factor. So if you have fixed L, and increasing T, which is often the plots you will see in the literature, then you first get maybe this is slightly misleading. Maybe I shouldn't have said this. Get a dip, but this is not the same dip as the disconnected part. This dip is a many body bump. Maybe I should call it bump. So you experience the bump here, and then you experience the ramp here, and then you experience the plateau, things like this. That's for fixed T. And here, this is not as interesting. I mean, this ramp, we can't understand this as these T diagrams there. And here, there's an exponential increase, which we discussed in a paper, which I don't have time to go through that paper, but I'll mention it briefly later. But we found that if we want to sweep away all the microscopic details and go to thermodynamic limits, we send T and L large. If you fix T, large L, you have exponential increase. The non-trivial things that we can get, it's actually in this along this line. So we fix we fix something we call X, okay, which is L divided by L thallus. And what is L thallus? So T thallus currently is a function of L, but you can also look as a function as L thallus as a function of T. So basically just flipping the diagram, rotating the diagram. So as a function of T, you get an L thallus. With this variable fixed and sending L and T large, you can actually realize that K minus T gives you a scaling function, which is e to the power of x minus one for this case. And we see that for two different models, actually, we have a very nice collapse. The only thing that to account for the finite Q is actually we numerically extract the thallus length here. And then we see that they collapse. Quite nicely. So this plot is quite important to us. It shows the universality of these results, and you see that this result without conserved quantities, this holds. Okay. So this is this.
Question?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to make sure about this universality. So if you just look at your previous map into classical model without referring to the numerical results, can you already see the universality?
Sorry. So I'm using universality in a very fake sense, in the sense that many systems should show this scaling, scaling function, as long as if you simulate them, if you change some details, it should not matter. From this, can I see that?
More concretely, in this model, you consider a particular configuration of the circuits. You choose some particular gates. So if you change the configurations of the gates and you change the depth of each flocate layer, do you have the same map? What happens to this mapping?
Yes, the mapping would not suffice. So the mapping is particular to the model. And then the results, we got some results from the mapping, like the partition function and the scaling function. But then that scaling function, we found that different models would follow that scaling function.
From the numerics?
from the numerics, yes. So green line is the analytics here, which is plotting this kappa. And then blue, sorry, I haven't gone through that just now. So the blue dots is actually the random phase model for finite Q. So these results are for infinite Q. But we find that for finite Q, you can numerically seek out for L thalers and see that they collapse there. And then for another model, which I denote in red here, which is actually the brick wall model, we see that we can do the same thing and they collapse into the same scaling function. So that is why we say that there is some universality here.
I see. Thanks.
Thanks. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, please.
And maybe this is related to Liujun's question earlier. So
right.
Is there an independent scaling argument indicating that the Thouless time is the only time scale you need to worry about here? I think that the mm-hmm. universality kind of follows from that assumption, right? Is that an assumption, or is you have some way of arguing?
We're not very this universality. Maybe I should add some quotes here. So we're not claiming that they're the only one time scale. So the system itself. So for special form factor, there will be Thouless time. But there are also other things that we think about. For instance, like whether their peak has something going on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
For some systems, also there actually are some for 2D. For instance, I show you something about 1D, but we also study things like 2Ds. For the mm-hmm. 2D case, the models also work. In post model, there will be phase transition, but mm-hmm. the phase transition would not be exactly in the peak. So probably the phase transition is somewhere here. So there are different things going on here. So we're not claiming that we're not claiming that there's only one. So I also mentioned briefly just now, but there are also timescale in other quantities, because this log L actually is awfully fast, right? So usually you expect something linear,
mm-hmm.
But this is faster than that. So certainly for this model, it's not capturing everything, because locality, there's another timescale in L. So some mm-hmm. kind of scrambling times you can also find out. But actually, I'm showing you this because this picture is all very nice. But the other model we also can make progress on. There will be much more familiar, this L square diffusive mm-hmm. modes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'll give a summary table soon.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for the question. Yeah. So for the second quantum classical mapping that I hope to present to you guys is when the systems have, when we introduce further structure. So one structure would be have a U1 charge. So you can imagine this circuit here. This is similar diagrams that we drew before, except that on the on-site degrees of freedom, you have the color degrees of freedom, tensor these spin degrees of freedom. So we will impose the symmetry, like the U1 symmetry, in the spin degrees of freedom on the ups and downs. And the color degrees of freedom are mainly there so that we can send Q large and do some analytics. Okay, so here, you can imagine this, each gate. So each degrees of freedom is 2Q. There are 2Q degrees of freedom, two for the two color, two spins, and Q for the color. So each gate would be 2Q square by 2Q square matrix. So it's actually, there are actually 4Q square columns here. And in particular, this one here would be Q square. This one here would be 2Q square. This one here would be Q square. And the thing we're imposing is quite simple. It's just when it's spin up, I can only allow you to go to the same the states with also spin up. So you have a block here. You have similarly for spin down, and the up down can go to down up, and up down can go to up down as well. So here I'm only going to describe this in an overview. You have special form factor. You compute it for large Q. It could be mapped to a Markov circuit, which is a quite non-trivial thing, which we're very interested in, at least I am very interested in. So you have this is mapped to compute the quantum special form factor for quantum systems, chaotic systems. It turns out that you can get that from computing a Markov matrix or a stochastic matrix. So those matrix just means that if you sum over the row of those matrix, it adds to one. So that those matrix preserve the probability if you add the matrix onto a probability factor. In particular, you can represent these kind of the dynamics of this matrix on a graph where each lattice, where each vertex is a possible spin configuration. effectively, what we have done here is that we have integrated out all the colors degrees of freedom. And we're left with the spin degrees of freedom represented by each dot here. And the link denotes a possible transition between different configurations. So in particular, we have local interaction. So here, you can apply it up, down, to down, up, and flip that to this the other dot. And you can also do that to the other domain wall on the other side here. So this graph, by studying this classical dynamics, you can understand the quantum dynamics. So this is another very nice thing out there that we find. If you go further to continuum time limit, so treat this, I forgot to say, so this M has the same geometry as the original circuit. So this M is still the same circuit, except that each gate is a Markov circuit. And I should probably also write down, the Markov circuit is exactly given by one, and then a bunch of one halves in the middle. It's this simple for U1 case. But we also do that for other cases, including dipole conserving cases. Realizing this is a classical matrix, and then you can go to the continuum time limit to go to some Hamiltonian called Roxler-Kivelsen Hamiltonian that is first studied in quantum diamond models. You can use different classical techniques like Fokker-Planck's equations or Langevin equations to study how the classical systems go to the ground state, which correspond to how the late time ramp is being approached. So the Thales time in the original quantum systems actually correspond to the spectral gap of this Markov chain, classical Markov chain, and the RK Hamiltonian. And this is also discussed in this two paper here. Okay, great. So this is, I'm only briefly discussing this, but this is something that we're actively working on.
Okay. Can I also ask a question here?
Yes.
So and this RK model has a feature that will only allow dimers. So if I view it as a quantum system, the Hilbert space is constrained. How does this constraint
So I'm using the RK in a more general sense. So I'm not specifically talking about the RK model of the quantum dimer itself. So quantum dimer, you have this, in general, RK can refer to systems that can be interpreted both classically and quantumly. So in particular, this Hamiltonian would have properties like the columns would add up to zero. It could be described by some graph, something like that. So So I'm not talking about the quantum dimer specifically. So if you're interested in this, Chris Hanley, of course, has a pioneer on this work. In some of his paper, he mentioned a few examples. Beyond the quantum dimer model. Okay, great, thanks. So there, this summary of this part of the talk would be this kind of results here. So we can do different with symmetries, with translational symmetry, with U1 symmetries and dipole, and there will be more coming up. And the main approximation we're using is large Q, and there are different classical model that we map to, and there are scaling forms that we can code to. Okay, so the other ones are dual unitaries and SYK. So I'm running slightly slow, so I'll quickly go to the other ones, the second part, which is much shorter than the first part. Okay, so another work that we do is actually when, because L goes in, you can ask what happens when in the thermodynamic limit when L goes to infinity. Actually, Thales would go to the right. And actually, this part here is not just from the microscopic physics. We also study, hopefully study things that are universal in this regime. And we study that, and we study that using something we call spectral Lyapunov. But this, I'm just advertising, so I'm not talking about this right now. So for open system, what would happen if these eigenvalues are in the complex plane? You can take a look at what the problem is. If you substitute just eigenlevels, which is complex in general, you have a phase contribute to the real part, but you also have this part which make this thing exponentially increasing or being suppressed. So this is actually not the natural thing to study. what we realize is that you actually want to treat this as a 2D gas. So you start off with the the correlation function between two eigenvalues with now the distance is parameterized by two parameters, omega and omega prime. And you can do Fourier transform. And this is what we call dissipative spectral form factor, which is in this paper with Jiaqin and Tamash. Okay, so the results really suggest that this is actually the natural way to study the eigenvalue correlation for quantum channels and Lindblad, which the next paper is going to be about. There is an interesting interpretation. You can actually write this guy. This is a complex because we have two omega parameter here. The Fourier transform will give you two parameters as well, two conjugate parameters. And this gives you the complex time, so which we call tau. And you can write this part as some kind of dot product, actually. So the left factor would be the first factor would be xy, and the second factor would be ts. It means that you can interpret DSFF in terms of SFF as the following. So for DSFF, if I want to compute just varying tau but fixed theta, then for a certain spectrum, then this is equivalent, because you can think of this as a dot product, as projecting all these eigenvalues onto this theta line and compute the spectral form factor for that object here. So you can actually think of it as a 1D spectral form factor again. The interesting thing now is because we're doing this projection, there'll be accidental degeneracies along this line. And this accidental degeneracies would be very interesting because they somehow give us an interesting shape of the solution of DSFF. Okay. For random matrix theory, you can solve and get a complicated expression. In large N, this would simplify to just basically the first and the third term. The second term is, again, for the disconnected part, actually. So this is actually a very simple solution, just a Gaussian, this part disappearing as a Gaussian function. So let's take a look at what this looks like. For chaotic system, we are modeled by, just to be clear, for chaotic system, we are modeled by the random matrix theory. The simplest one for the non-Hermitian case is so-called Ginibri, which is just matrix of complex Gaussian variables. That's all, without any extra symmetry. And this purple part would be the second term, and then it slowly it vanishes. And then later on, you will see that this part is the Gaussian, this part increases as a Gaussian function. What's interesting about this is that, first of all, there's no dependence on theta. So this originally is a function of theta, tau mod, and also theta, but there's no dependence on theta because of symmetry. It's perhaps obvious in the previously. Okay. And then there's also this dip RAM plateau. Again, this famous behavior, except that the RAM now, when n is large, you can think of it as just a quadratic RAM instead of a linear RAM, we're quite pleased about this. And then there is a time scale, which is also the Thales time, the Heisenberg time. Maybe I shouldn't call it time scale, but there is a scale, which is mod tau Heisenberg, which correspond to the inverse of the mean level spacing here. Therefore, it scales as square root of n. So in this plot, I'm plotting k against tau with collapsing different system size here. So different blues are actually different system size. Okay, so this gives you the kind of the reference. This is kind of like the SFF solution for Hermitian system, but this is the complex analog, this dip RAM plateau. And we see that, so this is just the last few slides, okay? So, and we see that we can check it for different examples. One of them would be the quantum kicktop, just a zero dimensional model of some spin J. And then you can, as you turn on and off the kick, the system goes to chaotic, which is this, and non-chaotic, which is just flat, which I forgot to say, which is a flat, which are independent Poisson, which is like eigenvalues that are not correlated. Okay, so you can also check that for other classical map, which is non-Hermitian. But the last line I want to say is just that the upcoming thing is that there's open many body quantum chaos where you can construct a random crowd circuit, and we see that there again it's this bump here. So for large enough time tau, sorry, let me go step by step. So you have this graph here. First, you can check the collapse. You can scale different things and see that the expected collapse works. The same collapse as the RMT collapse. And then in addition, you have different, have a bump here and show that for late enough time, RMT is recovered again. So this is for many bodies, quantum chaos. And we're quite excited about this. You can study the eigenvalue correlation and also like the eigenstate correlation. So thanks a lot for the attention. This concludes the talk. Let me turn on the light.
Thanks, Amos.
Yes.
Question?
I have one more question. The previous, the page, the next page. Yeah, I want to
ask, this page, yes.
What's the difference between this slide and the previous few slides you talked about?
Previous, this slide.
Yeah. What's the difference in the setup?
Yes. Sorry, I was rushing a little bit through there just now. So this one is a zero-dimensional system. So there is no spatial, it's not 1D, basically. That's one of the big difference. We also wrote this as a Krauss operator. So there could be a part, yeah, okay.
Uh-huh. I see, so can you go one slide back?
One side to the right or black?
To the left. Yeah, so here is still zero-dimensional.
Yes. So this one, I'm doing random matrix theory. So I first solved, basically what we did was that we first solved this object for the simplest case, which is the random matrix theory, Ginibri ensemble. And then we as usual, we want to say that, okay, this is random matrix theory. Hopefully this applies to many other models. Then we check it, for example, for this so-called quantum kicktop model, which is one of the standard models in zero-dimensional open system. And then we also check it for other things, like anything that's sufficiently generic, we believe that. Would display this level repulsion like this. This is basically saying, by the way, I didn't use these phrases, but this is saying that their level repulsion in the correlation in the eigenlevel. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then we went to this 1D version, which is a open area, which is quite exciting, actually. Both side closed and open systems are quite exciting. I think there are lots of concrete and exciting things that we can do.
Yeah, so for a cross operator, I can view it as a super operator on the density matrix, and that gives us to the complex eigenvalues.
Yes, exactly. So exactly, we're doing the super operator. So I didn't refute this in the talk, but we're doing the super operator. So the Hilbert space is quite, got enlarged quite a lot because of the super operator. So typically we can go to just L equals 6, 7, 8, because we have some conserved quantity here. I'm actually present one with a U1 charge, a circuit with some U1 charge here. And there are lots of interesting details that you can ask, like for Lindblad and for Krauss operator. For Lindblad, there are different symmetries. Right? Lindblad has different symmetries. And you can discuss those and see. And hopefully these kind of observables would detect some of these finer details. So previously, people only looked into nearest neighboring spacing, which I also should mention. So basically, they only look into correlation around in the nearest neighboring sense. They didn't look at anything long range, probably because it was a bit unnatural with the known thing, with the known object like the this guy. It's a bit unnatural. But here, we're looking at all scales. So, yeah. But then there are many exciting things. For instance, like the eigenstates correlation of that, of these kind of many-body open system.
Yeah. Can I ask one more question?
Of course.
Previously, at the very beginning, you mentioned at very large time, there should be the plateau. And your reason was at that large time, we're already below one over the minimal level space.
Yes, exactly.
Understand what this means. How is the fact that we are below the minimal level spacing related to a flat behavior of the
SFS? Yes, this this is really just saying that, okay, when we average this, if let's say we're fixing n, this en, if t is so large that then you don't have any difference small enough to resolve that, right? So because there's nothing close enough to this eigenlevel, so you can be probing this scale, but there's nothing there. So this automatically become delta mn. So as you sum over this, you kill one of the sum, so you just have sum of m, and this just becomes n, which is actually the plateau. That's one way of seeing it. So it all relies on the fact that the mean level spacing is of certain scale delta, and you're probing a time larger than 1/delta. So there's nothing that can resolve that. I don't know if resolve is the right word, but there's nothing that can compensate that.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the question.
Hey, Amos, can we go to that slide where you have this summary
table? Yes. Oh, yeah. So hopefully I didn't miss your reference. No.
Okay, so I'm curious how you can have a low time scale that is so short, like low.
Yes. Because this is not probing, unlike the single particle case, back then when Thales is doing this Thales time, they would be thinking about how quickly the left particle can go to the right side, for instance, for open system. But here, actually, this is exactly telling you that this is not doing this. So that is one way of thinking about this. Also, this results this particular result, Thales time itself, has to be taken with a grain of salt because it's obtained in large Q. Actually, the more solid result, I would say, is actually the scaling form, the scaling limits and stuff. There, we also allow different numerically obtained Thales time and Thales length. And in fact, we don't always see, so Thales length again is just the inverse of Thales time. So if Thales time is log L, Thales length will be exponential in time. And we numerically, we don't always see a very quick exponential.
So do you mean that if you fix Q to be a finite number and take the larger limit, then this Thales time doesn't go as log L in that case?
I think so. That's a good question. I think it would go polynomial in L, and probably whether it's going concave and convex. I think currently it's still faster than L. What we see numerically, and that reflects to the first part of the answer that I'm saying. I think it's not capturing operator spreading, for instance. So we shouldn't think about spectral statistics that's doing operator spreading. If you do operator spreading and you write out all the expansions, you will see that it depends also a bit on the eigenstate. So we're currently only taking information about eigenlevels. And eigenstate we're also quite interested in. So there are information hidden in the eigenstate that's necessary. Basically, that's what I'm saying.
So physically, okay, so suppose Q is very large, maybe compared to L. And in that case, what happens? So there's some kind of superluminal mode that propagate very fast, right? Beyond the light cone.
No, I wouldn't say so. So when Q goes to large, you saturate the light cone. So the operator spreading will saturate the light cone. So this is actually another result out there. So it means that, again, it means that this is not about operator spreading. I think operator spreading needs, I can state this one.
Okay, then. And how does the system know that system size L so quickly?
I think this is deficiency of spectral form factor. It doesn't capture all the, so even after Thales time, there's something happening out there, but it's not capturing spectral form factor. There'll be some scrambling time. It's later than spectral form factor.
Spectral form factor is, sorry, it's a very non-local observable, right? Is that kind of the point?
Exactly. So it's non-local, but sometimes maybe the understanding we have is not complete. So sometimes it's also captured different. This, for instance, for the charge case, this still sees the L square. which is something that is spreading and local. But then it, at the same time, we know that not for not for some case, it doesn't capture this, for instance, this log out thing. Okay. So this is a deficiency. So this is
just out of curiosity, suppose we do the same thing for a field theory that has Lorentz invariance, right? And then we know there's a real hard Lycon structure.
Yes.
If we do that in the presence of, say, translation invariance, do we expect to see this log L?
So I didn't spend time on this row. So actually for SYK, of course, this is for zero dimensional. This is the known result is that SYK for N Marana fermion, the T thalus is log N. And there's no local structure there.
Not surprising. Yeah.
If you do so there is a paper by Shankers and et al. This is more numerical paper that looks in a variety of models, and they see something consistent with log n. So as I was saying, this guy is large Q. So go to finite Q. I think this could be polynomial Q, polynomial in L or log L. And I think it's still faster than linear L, I think from the paper, if I didn't recall wrong.
So can I ask this log L, is it related also to this fast scrambling conjecture?
I haven't thought about it that way. So I didn't think so, but maybe I should have thought more carefully about that before I say that.
Thanks.
All right, that was quite a few questions. Anyone else want to ask anything? Well, if not, let's thanks Amos again.
Yeah,
thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for the nice talk.
Yeah, look forward to chatting with you guys tomorrow. Yes. Okay. All right. Thank you. Take care. Thank you. Bye bye. Take care.
Yeah.